the real, as it is called, or the objective, the external, the material, cannot be absolutely set apart from the subjective, or the imaginary, but there are quasi-attributes of the imaginary. There have been occurrences that I think were transmediumizations, because I think that they were marked by indications of having carried over, from an imaginative origin, into physical being, or into what is called real life, the quasi-attributes of their origin. A peculiarity of fires that are called or that used to be called spontaneous combustions of human bodies, is that the fires do not communicate to surrounding objects and fabrics, or that they extend only to a small degree around. There are stories of other such fires, which cannot be real fires, as compared with fires called real. In the St. Louis Globe Democrat, October 2, or about October 2, 1889, there is a story of restricted fires, said to have occurred in the home of Samuel Miller, upon a farm, 6 miles west of Findlay, Ohio. A bed had burst into flames, burning down to a heap of ashes, but setting nothing else afire, not even scorching the floor underneath. The next day, about the same time in the afternoon, a chest of clothes flamed, and was consumed, without setting anything else afire. The third day, at the same time, another bed, and nothing but the bed burned. See back to the fires in the house in Blattenboro, N.C., February, 1932. A long account of these fires, from a San Diego, Cal, newspaper, was sent to me by Margaret M. Page, of San Diego. In it, one of the phenomena considered most remarkable was that fires broke out close to inflammable materials that were unaffected by the flames. Names of several witnesses: Mayor J. A. Bridger, of Blattenboro, J. B. Edwards, a Wilmington health officer, and Drive S. S. Hutchinson, of Blattenboro. It is as if somebody had vengefully imagined fires, and in special places had localized fires, according to his visualizations. Such localizing, or focusing, omitting surroundings, is a quasi-attribute of all visualizations. One vividly visualizes a face, and a body is ignored by the imagination. Let somebody visualize a bed afire, and exhaust his imaginative powers in this specialization, I conceive of the bed burning, as imagined, and nothing else burning, because nothing else was included in the mental picture that transmediumized, it having been taken for granted, by the visualizer, that, like a fire of physical origin, this fire would extend. It seems to me to be only ordinarily impossible to understand the burning of a woman on an unscorched bed as the realization of an imagined scene in which the burning body was pictured, with neglect of anything else consuming. See back to unsatisfactory attempts to attribute punctures of window panes and automobile shields, to a missile-less weapon. The invisible bullet stopped short, after penetrating glass. If we can think of an intent, more mischievous than malicious, that was only upon shooting through glass, and that gave no consideration to subsequent courses of bullets, we can think of occurrences that took place, as visualized, and as restricted by visualizations. Doings in closed rooms but my monism, by which I accept that all psychical magic links somewhere with more or less commonplace physical magic. New York Times, June 18, 1880 Rochester, N.Y. A woman dead in her bed, and the bedpost hacked as if with a hatchet. It was known that nobody had entered this room. But something had killed this woman, leaving no sign of either entrance or exit. It was during a thunderstorm, and the woman had been killed by lightning. The man of one of our stories, J. Temple Thurston, alone in his room, and that a pictorial representation of his death by fire was enacting in a distant mind, and that into the phase of existence that is called real stole the imaginary, scorching his body, but not his clothes, because so was pictured the burning of him, and that, hours later, there came into the mind of the sorcerer a fear that this imposition of what is called the imaginary upon what is called the physical bore quasi-attributes of its origin, or was not realistic, or would be, in physical terms, unaccountable, and would attract attention, and that the fire in the house was visualized, and was realized, but by a visualization that in turn left some particulars unaccounted for. Lavinia Farrar was a woman of independent means. hosts of men and women have been shot, or stabbed, or poisoned, because of their independent means. But that Mrs. Farrar was thought to death, or that upon her, too, out of the imaginary world in somebody's mind, stole a story that it made of her, too, so fictional a being that of her death there is no explanation in ordinary, realistic terms. That here, too, there was an afterthought, or an afterpicturation, which, by way of attempted explanation, realized a knife and blood on the floor, but overlooked other details that made this occurrence inexplicable in terms of ordinary murders, or that this woman had been stabbed in the heart, through unpunctured clothes, because it was, with the neglect of everything else, the wound in the heart that had been visualized. The germ of this expression is in anybody's acceptance that a stigmatic girl can transfer a wound, as pictured in her mind, into appearance upon her body. The expression requires that there may be external, as well as personal, stigmatism. It seems to me to be as nearly unquestionable as anything in human affairs goes, that there have been stigmatic girls. There may have been many cases of different kinds of personal stigmatism. There are emotions that are as intense as religious excitation. One of them is terror. The story of Isidore Fink is a story of a fear that preceded a murder. It could be that Fink's was a specific fear, of somebody whom he had harmed, and not a general fear of the whole UPS that, at the time, were so prevalent in New York City. According to Police Commissioner Mulrooney, it was impossible, in terms of ordinary human experience, to explain this closed-room murder. Or Isidore Fink, at work in his laundry and his mind upon somebody whom he had injured, and that his fears of revenge were picturing an assassination of which he was the victim, that his physical body was seized upon by his own picturization of himself, as shot by an enemy. 31. In February, 1885, in an English prison, there was one of the dream-like occurrences that the materialists think are real. But every character concerned in it was fading away, so that now there is probably no survivor. From time to time repairs had to be made, because the walls of the prison were dissolving. By way of rusts, the iron bars were disappearing. Upon February 23, 1885, as we say, in terms of our fanciful demarcations, just as if a 23rd of February, which is only relative to rhythms of sunshine, could be a real day, just as if one could say really where a January stops and a February begins, just as if one could really pick a period out of time, and say that there ever was really a year 1885. Early in what is called a morning of what is so arbitrarily and fancifully called the 23rd of February, 1885, John Lee, in his cell, in the penitentiary, at Exeter, England, was waiting to be hanged. In the yard of a prison of stone, with bars of iron, John Lee was led past a group of hard and motionless witnesses, to the scaffold. There were newspaper men present. Though they probably considered it professional to look as expressionless as stones, or bars of iron, there was nothing in Lee's case to be sentimental about. His crime had been commonplace and sordid. He was a laborer, who had lived with an old woman, who had a little property, and, hoping to get that, he had killed her. John Lee was led past a group, almost of minerals. It was a scene of the mechanism and solidity of legal procedure, as nearly real as mechanism and solidity can be. Noose on his neck, and up on the scaffold they stood him on a trap door. The door was held in position by a bolt. When this bolt was drawn, the door fell. John Lee, who hadn't a friend, and hadn't a dollar. The sheriff of Exeter, behind whom was Great Britain. The sheriff waved his hand. It represented justice and Great Britain. The bolt was drawn, but the trap door did not fall. John Lee stood with the noose around his neck. It was embarrassing. He should be strangling. There is something of an etiquette in all things, and this was indecorum. They tinkered with the bolt. There was no difficulty, whatsoever, with the bolt, but when it was drawn, with John Lee standing on the trap door, the door would not fall. Something unreasonable was happening. Just what is the procedure, in the case of somebody, who is standing erect, when he should be dangling. The sheriff ordered John Lee back to his cell. The people in this prison yard were not so stolid. They fluttered, and groups of them were talking it over. But there was no talk that could do John Lee any good. This was what is called stern reality. The sheriff did not flutter. I have a note upon him. 20 years later, he was in trouble with a religious sect of which he was a member, because he ordered his beer by the barrel. He was as solid as beer and beef and the British government. The warders looked into the matter thoroughly, except that there wasn't anything to look into. Every time they drew back the bolt, with John Lee out of the way, the door fell, as it should fall. One of the warders stood in Lee's place, where, instead of placing the noose around his neck, he clung to the rope. The bolt was drawn, the door fell, as it should fall, and down dropped the warder, as he should drop. There was a woman they could not push. A man they could not crucify. The man they could not drown. There was the man they could not imprison. The dog they could not lose.